And they also know that Murray wasn't there. Not exactly, anyway. The rest of that operation is locked up tight. What actually happened? And need to know applied to Arnie now. The president gestured and spoke as one explaining something to a parent. There were two operations, Showboat and Reciprocity. One of them involved putting troops into Colombia. The idea was to bird dog drug flights. Those flights were then splashed. What? Shot down by the Air Force. Well, some were intercepted, the crews arrested and processed quietly. Some other things happened, and then Emil Jacobs got killed, and Reciprocity got laid on. We started dropping bombs on places. Things got a little out of hand. Some civilians got killed, and it all started coming apart. "How much did you know?" Van Damme asked. "I didn't know jack shit until late in the game. Jim Greer was dying then, and I was handling his work, but that was mostly NATO stuff. I was cut out of it until after the bombs started falling. I was in Belgium when that happened. I saw it on TV, would you believe? Cutter was actually running the operation. He suckered Judge Moore and Bob Ritter into starting it, and then he tried to close it down. That's when things got crazy. Cutter tried to cut off the soldiers. The idea was that they'd just disappear. I found out. I got into Ritter's personal records vault. So I went down into Colombia with the rescue crew, and we got most of them out. It wasn't much fun, Ryan reported. There was some shooting involved, and I worked one of the guns on the chopper. A crewman, a sergeant named Buck Zimmer, got killed on the last extraction, and I've been looking after his family ever since. Liz Elliott got a hold of that and tried to use it against me a while later.
There's more to it, Arnie said quietly.
Oh, yeah. I had to report the operations to the select committee, but I didn't want to rip the government apart. So I talked it over with Trent and Fellows, and I came in to see the president. We talked for a while, and then I stepped out of the room, and Sam and Al talked with him for a while. I'm not exactly sure what they agreed on, but...
But he threw the election. He dumped his campaign manager, and his campaign was for crap the whole way.
Christ, Jack, what did you do? Arnie demanded.
His face was pale now, but for political reasons. And all along Van Damme had figured that he'd run a brilliant and successful campaign for Bob Fowler, unseating a popular sitting president. And so a fix had been in, and he'd never found out?
Ryan closed his eyes. He just forced himself to relive a dreadful night. I terminated an operation that was technically legal, but teetering right on the edge. I closed it down quietly. The Colombians never found out. I thought I prevented another Watergate domestically, and a god-awful international incident. Sam and Al signed off on it. The records are sealed until long after we're all dead. Whoever leaked that must have picked up on a couple of rumors and made a few good guesses.
What did I do? I think I obeyed the law as best I could.
No, Arnie, I did not break the law. I followed the rules. It wasn't easy, but I did.
The eyes opened.
So, Arnie, how will that play in Peoria?
Why couldn't you have just reported to Congress and...
Think back, the president said. It wasn't just the one thing, okay? That's when Eastern Europe was coming unglued. The Soviet Union was still there but teetering. Some really big things were happening. And if our government had come apart, right then, with everything else happening, hell, it could have been a mess like nobody's ever seen. America couldn't... We would not have been able to help settle Europe down if we'd been pissing around with a domestic scandal. And I was the guy who had to make the call and take the action, right now, or those soldiers would have been killed. Think about the box I was in, will you?
Arnie, I couldn't go to anybody for guidance on that one, okay? Admiral Greer was dead. Moore and Ritter were compromised. The president was up to his eyeballs in it. At the time, I thought he was running the show through Cutter. He wasn't. He got finessed into it by that incompetent political bastard. I didn't know where to go, so I went to the FBI for help. I couldn't trust anybody but Dan Murray and Bill Shaw, and one of our people at Langley on the operational side.
Bill, Did you know he was a J.D.? Worked me through the law part of it. And Murray helped with the recovery operation. They had an investigation started on Cutter. It was a code word op, I think they called it Odyssey. And they were about to go to a U.S. magistrate for criminal conspiracy, but Cutter killed himself. There was an FBI agent 50 yards behind him when he jumped in front of the bus. You've met him, Pat O'Day. Nobody ever broke the law except for Cutter. The operations themselves were within the Constitution. At least that's what Shaw said. But politically, yeah, even I'm not that ignorant. So here I am, Arnie. I didn't break the law. I served my country's interests as best I could under the circumstances. And look what good it's done me. Damn. How is it that Bob Fowler never was told? That was Sam and Al. They thought it would have poisoned Fowler's presidency. Besides, I don't really know what the two of them said to the president, do I? I never wanted to know. I never found out. And all I have is speculation. Pretty good speculation, Ryan admitted. But that's all. Jack, it's not often I don't know what to say. Say it anyway, the president ordered. It's going to get out. The media has enough now to put some pieces together, and that will force Congress to launch an investigation. What about the other stuff? It's all true, Ryan said. Yeah, we got our hands on Red October. Yeah, I got Gerasimov out myself. My idea, my operation, nearly got my ass killed, but there you go. If we hadn't, then Gerasimov was poised to launch his own coup to topple Andrei Narmanov. And then there might still be a Warsaw Pact, and the bad old days might never have gone away. So we compromised the bastard, and he didn't have any choices but to get on the airplane. He's still pissed, despite all we did to get him set up over here. But I understand his wife and daughter like America just fine. Did you kill anybody? Arnie asked. In Moscow, no. In the sub. He was trying to self-destruct the submarine. He killed one of the ship's officers and shot up two others pretty bad. But I punched his ticket myself. And I had nightmares about it for years. In another reality, Van Damme thought, his president would be a hero. But reality and public politics had little in common. He noted that Ryan hadn't recounted his story about Bob Fowler and the aborted nuclear launch. The chief of staff had been around for that one, and he knew that 3 days later, J. Robert Fowler had come nearly apart at the realization at how he'd been saved from mass murder on a Hitlerian scale. There was a line in Hugo's Les Misérables that had struck the older man when he'd first read the book in high school. What evil good can be. Here was another case. Ryan had served his country bravely and well more than once, but not one of the things he'd done would survive public scrutiny. Intelligence, love of country, and courage merely added up to a series of events which anyone could twist out of recognition into scandal. And Ed Keelty knew how to do just that. "How do we spin control all this?" the president asked. "What else do I need to know?" The files on Red October and Gerasimov are at Langley. The Colombian thing, well, you know what you need to know. I'm not sure even I have the legal right to unseal the records. On the other hand, you want to destabilize Russia? This will do it. Red October, Golovko thought. Then he looked up at the high ceiling of his office.
Ivan Nemetovich, you clever bastard. Zvot vayo mat.
The curse was spoken in quiet admiration. From the first moment he'd met Ryan, he'd underestimated him, and even with all the contacts, direct and indirect, that had followed, he had to admit he'd never stopped doing it. So that was how he'd compromised Gerasimov. And in so doing, he'd saved Russia, perhaps. But a country was supposed to be saved from within, not without. Some secrets were supposed to be kept forever, because they protected everyone equally. This was such a secret. It would embarrass both countries now. For the Russians, it was the loss of a valuable national asset through high treason. Worse still, something their intelligence organs had not discovered, which was quite incredible on reflection. But the cover stories had been good ones, and the loss of 2 Hunter submarines in the same operation had made the affair something that the Soviet Navy had every desire to forget. And so they hadn't looked far beyond the cover story. Sergei Nikolaevich knew the second part better than the first. Ryan had forestalled a coup d'etat. Golovko supposed that Ryan might as easily have told him what was happening and left it to the Soviet Union's internal organs. But no. Intelligence services turned everything to their advantage, and Ryan would have been mad not to have done so here. Gerasimov must have sung like a canary. He knew the Western aphorism, and given up everything he'd known. Ames, for one, had been identified that way, he was sure, and Ames had been a virtual diamond mine for KGB.
"And you always told yourself that Ivan Nemetovich was a gifted amateur," Golovko thought.
But even his professional admiration was tempered. Russia might soon need help. How could she go for that help to someone who, it would now be known, had tampered with his country's internal politics like a puppeteer? That realization was worth another oath, not spoken in admiration of anything. Public waterways are free for the passage of all, and so the Navy couldn't do anything more than prevent the charter boat from getting too close to the 810 dock. Soon it was joined by another, then more still, until a total of 11 cameras were pointing at the covered graving dock, now empty with the demise of most of America's missile submarines, and also empty of another which had briefly lived there, not American, or so the story went. It was possible to access the Navy's personnel records via computer, and some were doing that right now, checking for former crewmen of USS Dallas. An early morning call to ComSub Pack concerning his tenure as commanding officer of Dallas got no farther than his public affairs officer, who was well-schooled in no-commenting sensitive inquiries. Today he'd get more than his fair share. So would others.
"This is Ron Jones."
"This is Tom Donner at NBC News."
"That's nice," Jonesy said diffidently.
"I watch CNN myself."
"Well, maybe you want to watch our show tonight. I'd like to talk to you about..."
"I read the Times this morning. It's delivered up here. No comment," he added.
But yes. I used to be a submariner, and they call us the Silent Service. Besides, that was a long time ago. I run my own business now. Married, kids, the whole 9 yards, you know. You were lead sonar man aboard USS Dallas when...
"Mr. Donner, I signed a secrecy agreement when I left the Navy. I don't talk about the things we did, okay?"
It was his first encounter with a reporter, and it was living up to everything he'd ever been told to expect.
"Then all you have to do is tell us that it never happened."
"That what never happened?" Jones asked.
"The defection of a Russian sub named Red October."
"You know the craziest thing I ever heard as a sonar man?"
"What's that?"
"Elvis."
He hung up.
Then he called Pearl Harbor. With daylight, the TV trucks rolled through Winchester, Virginia, rather like the Civil War armies that had exchanged possession of the town over 40 times. He didn't actually own the house. It could not even be said that CIA did. The land title was in the name of a paper corporation, in turn owned by a foundation whose directors were obscure. But since real property ownership in America is a matter of public record, and since all corporations and foundations were also, that data would be run down in less than 2 days, despite the tag on the files which told the clerks in the county courthouse to be creatively incompetent in finding the documents. The reporters who showed up had still photos and taped file footage of Nikolai Gerasimov, and long lenses were set up on tripods to aim at the windows, a quarter mile away, past a few grazing horses which made for a nice touch on the story. CIA treats Russian spymaster like visiting king. The two security guards at the house were going ape, calling Langley for instructions, but the CIA's public affairs office, itself rather an odd institution, didn't have a clue on this one, other than falling back on the stance that this was private property.
Whether or not that was legally correct under the circumstances was something CIA's lawyers were checking out, and that therefore the reporters couldn't trespass. It had been years since he'd had much to laugh about. Sure, there had been the occasional light moment, but this was something so special that he'd never even considered its possibility. He'd always thought himself an expert on America. Gerasimov had run numerous spy operations against the main enemy, as the United States had once been called in the non-existent country he'd once served, but he admitted to himself that you had to come here and live here for a few years to understand how incomprehensible America was, how nothing made sense, how literally anything could happen, and the madder it was, the more likely it seemed. No imagination was sufficient to predict what would happen in a day, much less a year, and here was the proof of it. Poor Ryan, he thought, standing by the window and sipping his coffee. In his country, for him it would always be the Soviet Union, this would never have happened. A few uniformed guards and a hard look would have driven people off. Or if the look alone didn't, then there were other options. But not in America, where the media had all the freedom of a wolf in the Siberian pines. He nearly laughed at that thought, too. In America, wolves were a protected species. Didn't these fools know that wolves killed people?
"Perhaps they will go away," Maria said, appearing at his side.
"I think not."
"Then we must stay inside until they do," his wife said, terrified at the development.
He shook his head. "No, Maria."
"But what if they send us back?"
"They won't. They can't. One doesn't do that with defectors. It's a rule," he explained. "We never sent Philby or Burgess or McLean back, drunks and degenerates. Oh, no, we protected them, bought them their liquor, and let them diddle with their perversions, because that's the rule."
He finished his coffee and walked back to the kitchen to put the cup and saucer in the dishwasher. He looked at it with a grimace. His apartment in Moscow and his dacha in the Lenin Hills, probably renamed since his departure, hadn't had an appliance like that one. He'd had servants to do such things. No more. In America, convenience was a substitute for power, and comfort the substitute for status. Servants. It could all have been his. The status, the servants, the power. The Soviet Union could still have been a great nation, respected and admired across the world. He would have become General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. He could then have initiated the needed reforms to clear out the corruption and get the country moving again. He would probably have made a full rapprochement with the West, and made a peace. But a peace of equals it would have been, not a total collapse. He'd never been an ideologue after all, though poor old Alexandrov had thought him so, since Gerasimov had always been a party man. Well, what else could you be in a one-party state? Especially if you knew that destiny had selected you for power. But no. Destiny had betrayed him, in the person of John Patrick Ryan, on a cold, snowy Moscow night, sitting, he recalled, in a streetcar barn, sitting in a resting tram. And so now he had comfort and security. His daughter would soon be married to what the Americans called old money, what other countries called the nobility, and what he called worthless drones, the very reason the Communist Party had won its revolution. His wife was content with her appliances and her small circle of friends, and his own anger had never died. Ryan had robbed him of his destiny, of the sheer joy of power and responsibility, of being the arbiter of his nation's path. And then Ryan had taken to himself that same destiny, and the fool didn't know how to make use of it. The real disgrace was to have been done in by such a person. Well, there was one thing to be done, wasn't there? Gerasimov walked into the mudroom that led out the back, selected a leather jacket, and walked outside. He thought for a moment. Yes, he'd light a cigarette, and just walk up the driveway to where they were, 400 meters away. Along the way, he would consider how to couch his remarks, and his gratitude to President Ryan. He'd never stopped studying America,
and his observations on how the media thought would now stand him in good stead, he thought.
"Did I wake you up, Skipper?" Jones asked. It was about 4 in the morning at Pearl Harbor.
"Not hardly. You know my PAO is a woman, and she's pregnant. I hope all this crap doesn't put her into early labor."
Rear Admiral, Vice Admiral Selectee now, Mancuso, was at his desk, and his phone, on his instructions, wasn't ringing without a good reason. An old shipmate was such a reason.
"I got a call from NBC asking about a little job we did in the Atlantic."
"What did you say?"
"What do you think, Skipper? Zip."
In addition to the honor of the situation, there was also the fact that Jones did most of his work with the Navy.
"But..."
"Yeah, but somebody is gonna talk. Somebody always does.
They know too much already. The Today Show is doing a live shot from Norfolk, the 810 dock. You can guess what they're saying."
Mancuso thought about flipping his office TV on, but it was still too early for the NBC morning news show. No, he did flip it on and selected CNN. They were doing sports now, and the top of the hour was coming.
"Next they might ask about another job we did, the one involving a swimmer."
"Open lines, Dr. Jones," ComSubPAC warned.
"I didn't say where, Skipper. It's just something you'll want to think about."
"Yeah," Mancuso agreed.
"Maybe you can tell me one thing."
"What's that, Ron?"
"What's the big deal?" "I mean, sure, I won't talk, and neither will you, but somebody will, sure as hell. Too good a sea story not to tell."
"But what's the big deal, Bart? Didn't we do the right thing?"
"I think so," the Admiral replied.
"But I guess people just like a story."
"You know, I hope Ryan runs. I'll vote for him. Pretty cool stuff, bagging the head of the KGB and..."
"Ron!"
"Skipper, I'm just repeating what they're saying on TV, right? I have no personal knowledge of that at all."
"Damn," Jonesy thought. "What a sea story this one is. And it's all true."
At the other end of the line, the breaking news graphic came up on Mancuso's TV screen.
"Yes, I am Nikolai Gerasimov," the face said on screens all over the world.
There were at least 20 reporters clustered on the other side of the stone fence, and the hard part was hearing one of the shouted questions.
"Is it true that you were... Are you... Were you... Is it true that..."
"Silence, please."
He held up his hand. It took 15 seconds or so.
"Yes, I was at one time the chairman of KGB. Your President Ryan induced me to defect, and I have lived in America ever since, along with my family."
"How did he get you to defect?" a reporter shouted.
"You must understand that the intelligence business is, as you say, rough. Mr. Ryan plays the game well. At the time there was ongoing power struggle. CIA opposed my faction in favor of Andrei Ilyich Narmanov. So he came to Moscow under cover of advisor to start talks. He claimed that he wanted to give me information to make the meeting happen, yes?"
Gerasimov had decided that downgrading his English skills would make him seem more credible to the cameras and microphones.
"Actually, you can say he trapped me with accusation that I was going to create, how you say, treason? Not true, but effective. And so I decide to come to America with my family. I come by airplane. My family come by submarine."
"What? Submarine?"
"Yes, was submarine Dallas."
He paused and smiled rather grimly.
"Why are you so hard on President Ryan? He served his country well." "A master spy," Gerasimov said admiringly.
"Well, there goes that story." Bob Holtzman muted his television and turned to his managing editor.
"Sorry, Bob."
The editor handed the copy back. It was to have run in 3 days. Holtzman had done a masterful job of assembling his information, and then taken the time to integrate it all into a cohesive and flattering picture of the man whose office was only 5 blocks from his own. It was about spin, that most favored of Washington words. Somebody had changed the spin, and that was that. Once the initial story went out, It was impossible even for an experienced journalist like Holtzman to change it, especially if his own paper didn't support him.
"Bob," the editor said with a measure of embarrassment, "your take on this is different than mine. What if this guy's a cowboy? I mean, okay, getting the submarine was one thing, Cold War and all that, but tampering with internal Soviet politics? Isn't that close to an act of war?"
That's not what it was really about. He was trying to get an agent out, codenamed Cardinal. Gerasimov and Alexandrov were using that spy case to topple Narmanov and kill off the reforms he was trying to initiate.
"Well, Ryan can say that all day if he wants. That's not how it's going to come across. Master spy? Just what we need to run the country, huh?"
"Ryan isn't like that, goddammit," Holtzman swore. "He's a straight shooter right out of..."
"Yeah, he shoots straight, all right. He's killed at least 3 people."
"Killed, Bob?
How the hell did Roger Durling ever get it into his head that this was the right guy to be vice president? I mean, Ed Kielty isn't much of a prize, but at least..."
"At least he knows how to manipulate us, Ben. He suckered that airhead on TV, and then he suckered the rest of us into following the story his way."
"Well..." Ben Sadler ran out of things to say at that point. "It's factual, isn't it?"
"That isn't the same as true, Ben, and you know it."
"Now, this is going to have to be looked into. Ryan looks like a guy who's played fast and loose with everything he's touched. Next, I want this Colombian story run down. Now, can you do it? Your contacts at the agency are pretty good, but I have to tell you, I worry about your objectivity on this."
"You don't have a choice, Ben. If you want to keep up, it's my story.
Of course, you can always just reword what the Times says," Holtzman added, making his editor flush. "Life could be tough in the media, too." "Your story, Bob. Just make sure you deliver. Somebody broke the law, and Ryan's the one who covered everything up and came out smelling like a rose. I want that story."
Sadler stood.
"I have an editorial to write."
Daryai could scarcely believe it. The timing could scarcely have been better. He was days away from his next goal, and his target was about to descend into the abyss entirely without his help. With his help, of course, the fall would be farther still.
"Is that what it appears to be?"
"It would seem so," Badrine replied. "I can do some quick research and be back to you in the morning."
"Is it truly possible?" the Ayatollah persisted.
"Remember what I told you about lions and hyenas? For America, it is a national sport. It is no trick. They don't do such tricks. However, let me make sure. I have my methods."
"Tomorrow morning, then."
Chapter 34 www.terror.org He had much work to do along those lines anyway. Back in his office, Badrine activated his desktop computer. This had a high-speed modem and a dedicated fiber-optic telephone line that ran to an Iranian, UIR now, embassy in Pakistan, and from there another line to London, where he could link into the World Wide Web without fear of a trace. What had once been a fairly simple exercise for police agencies—that's what counter-espionage and counter-terrorism was, after all—was now virtually impossible. Literally millions of people could access all the information mankind had ever developed, and more quickly than one could walk to one's car for a trip to the local library. Badrine started by hitting press areas, major newspapers from the Times in Los Angeles to the Times in London, with Washington and New York in between. The major papers all presented much the same basic story, quicker on the web than in the printed editions, in fact, though the initial editorial comment differed somewhat from one to another. The stories were vague on dates, and he had to remind himself that the mere repetition of the content didn't guarantee accuracy, but it felt real. He knew Ryan had been an intelligence officer, knew that the British, the Russians, and the Israelis respected him. Surely stories such as these would explain that respect. They also made him slightly uneasy, a fact which would have surprised his master. Ryan was potentially a more formidable adversary than Daryai appreciated. He knew how to take decisive action in difficult circumstances,
and such people were not to be underestimated. It was just that Ryan was out of his element now, and that was plain from the news coverage. As he changed from one home page to another, a brand new editorial came up. It called for a congressional inquiry into Ryan's activities at CIA. A statement from the Colombian government asked in clipped diplomatic terms for an explanation of the allegations, and that would start another firestorm. How would Ryan respond to the charges and the demands? An open question, but Ryan judged. He was an unknown quantity. That was disturbing. He printed up the more important articles and editorials for later use, and then went on with his real business. There was a dedicated home page for conventions and trade shows in America, probably for the use of travel agents, he thought. Well, that wasn't far off. Then it was just a matter of selecting them by city. That told him the identity of the convention centers, typically large barn-like buildings. Each of those had a home page as well, to boast of their capabilities. Many showed diagrams and travel directions. All gave phone and fax numbers. These he collected as well until he had 24, a few extra, just in case. One could not send one of his travelers to a ladies' underwear show, for example, although, he chuckled to himself, fashion and fabric shows. These would be for the winter season, though summer had not yet come even to Iran. Automobile shows. These, he saw, traced across America as the various car and truck manufacturers showed their wares like a traveling circus. So much the better. Circus, he thought, and punched up another home page. But no, it was just a few weeks too early in the year for that. Too bad. Too bad indeed, Bedrine groused. Didn't the big circuses travel in private trains? Damn. But that was just bad timing. And bad timing could not be helped. The auto show would have to do. And all the others. Group 2's members were all fatally ill now, and it was time to end their suffering. It wasn't so much mercy as efficiency. There was no point at all in risking the lives of the medical corpsmen by treating people condemned to death by law and science both. And so, like the first group, they were dispatched by large injections of Dilaudid, as Mahoudi watched the TV. The relief for the medics was visible, even through the cumbersome plastic suits. In just a few minutes, all of the test subjects were dead. The same procedures, as before, would be exercised, and the doctor congratulated himself that they'd worked so well, and no extraneous personnel had been infected. That was mainly because of their ruthlessness. Other places, proper hospitals, would not be so lucky, he knew, already mourning the loss of fellow practitioners. It was a strange truism of life that second thoughts came only when it was too late for them. He could no more stop what was to come than he could stop the turning of the earth. The medics started loading the infected bodies on the gurneys, and he turned away. He didn't need to see it again. Mahoudi walked into the lab. Another set of technicians was now loading the soup into containers known as flasks. They had 1,000 times more than was needed for the operations, but the nature of the exercise was such that it was actually easier to make too much than it was to make just enough. And, the director had explained offhandedly, one never knew when more might be needed. The flasks were all made of stainless steel, actually a specialized alloy that didn't lose its strength in extreme cold. Each was 3/4 filled and sealed. Then it could be sprayed with a caustic chemical to make certain the outside was clean. Next, it would be placed on a cart and rolled to the cold storage locker in the building's basement, there to be immersed in liquid nitrogen. The Ebola virus particles could stay there for decades, too cold to die, completely inert, waiting for their next exposure to warmth and humidity, and a chance to reproduce and kill. One of the flasks stayed in the lab, sitting in a smaller cryogenic container, about the size of an oil drum but somewhat taller, with an LED display showing the interior temperature. It was something of a relief that his part in the drama would soon be over. Modi stood by the door, watching the lesser personnel do their jobs, and probably they felt the same. Soon the 20 spray containers would be filled and removed from the building, and every square centimeter of the building would be rigorously cleaned, making everything safe again. The director would spend all of his time in his office, and Modi, well, he couldn't reappear at the World Health Organization, could he? He was dead, after all, killed in the airplane crash just off the Libyan coast. Someone would have to generate a new identity and passport for him before he could travel again, assuming that he ever could. Or, perhaps as a security measure... No. Even the director wasn't that ruthless, was he? Hello, I'm calling for Dr. Ian McGregor. Who's calling, please? This is Dr. Lorenz at CDC Atlanta. Wait, please.
Gus had to wait for 2 minutes by his watch, long enough to light his pipe and open a window. The younger staffers occasionally chided him about the habit, but he didn't inhale, and it was good for thinking. "This is Dr. McGregor," a young voice said. "This is Gus Lorenz in Atlanta." "Oh, how do you do, Professor?" "How are your patients doing?" Lorenz asked from 7 time zones away. He liked the sound of McGregor, clearly working a little late. The good ones did a lot of that. "The male patient isn't doing well at all, I'm afraid. The child, however, is recovering nicely." "Indeed. Well, we examined the specimens you sent. Both contained the Ebola virus, Mayinga substrain." "You're quite certain?" the younger man asked. "No doubt about it, doctor. I ran the tests myself." "I was afraid of that. I sent another set to Paris, but they haven't got back to me yet." "I need to know a few things." On his end of the line, Lawrence had a pad out. "Tell me more about your patients." "There's a problem with that, Professor Lorenz," McGregor had to say. He didn't know if the line might be bugged, but in a country like Sudan it was not something he could discount. On the other hand, he had to say something, and so he started picking his way through the facts he could disclose. "I saw you on TV last night." Dr. Alexander had decided to see Kathy Ryan at lunch again for that very reason. He'd taken a liking to her. Who would have expected an eye-cutter and laser jockey? For Alex, these were more mechanical specialties than the true medicine he practiced. Even that profession had its rivalries, and he felt that way about almost all surgical specialties. To take an interest in genetics. Besides, she probably needed a friendly voice.
"That's nice," Carolyn Ryan replied, looking down at her chicken salad as he took his seat. The bodyguard, Alexander saw, merely looked unhappily tense.
"You did okay."
"Think so?"
She looked up, saying evenly,
"I wanted to rip his face off."
"Well, that didn't quite come across. You were pretty supportive of your husband. You came across smart."
"What is it with reporters? I mean, why..."
Alex smiled. "Doctor, when a dog urinates on a fire hydrant, he's not committing vandalism, he's just being a dog."
Roy Altman nearly choked on his drink.
"Neither one of us ever wanted this, you know," she said, still unhappy enough to miss the jibe.
Professor Alexander held his hands up in mock surrender.
"Been there, done that, ma'am. Hey, I never wanted to join the army. They drafted me right out of med school. It turned out all right, making colonel and all. I found an interesting field to keep the brain busy, and it pays the bills, you know."
"I don't get paid for this abuse," Kathy objected, albeit with a smile.
"And your husband doesn't get paid enough," Alex added.
"He never has. Sometimes I wonder why he doesn't just do the job for free, turn the checks back in, just to make the point that he's worth more than they pay him."
"You think he would have made a good doc?"
Her eyes brightened. "I've told him that. Jack would have been a surgeon, I think. No, maybe something else, like what you're in.
He's always liked poking around and figuring things out. And saying what he thinks. That almost started a laugh. Always. Well, guess what? He comes across as a good guy. I've never met him, but I liked what I saw. Sure as hell he's no politician, and maybe that's not a bad thing once in a while. You want to lighten up a little, Doctor? What's the worst thing that can happen? He leaves the job, goes back to whatever he wants to do, teaching, I guess from what he said, and you're still a doc with Alaska on the wall. The worst thing that can happen... You have Mr. Altman here to take care of that, don't you? Alexander looked him over. I imagine you're big enough to stand in the way of a bullet. The Secret Service agent didn't reply, but his look at Alex told the tale. Yes, he'd stop one for his principal. You guys can't talk about this sort of thing, can you? Yes, sir, we can, if you ask. Altman had wanted to say this all day. He'd seen the TV special, too. And as had often happened before, there was light talk in the detail this morning about popping a cap on the reporter in question. The Secret Service had a fantasy life, too. Dr. Ryan, we like your family a lot, but I'm not just saying that to be polite, okay? We don't always like our principals, but we like all of you. Hey, Kathy! It was Dean James passing by with a smile and a wave. Hi, Dave. Then she noted a few waves from faculty friends. So she wasn't as alone as she thought. Okay, Kathy, are you married to James Bond or what? In a different context, the question might have set her off, but Alexander's Creole eyes were twinkling at her. I know a little. I got briefed in on some of it when President Durling asked Jack to be vice president. But I can't. He held up his hand. I know. I still have a security clearance because I still drive up to Fort Detrick once in a while. It isn't like the movies. You don't do stuff like that and have a drink, kiss the girl, and drive away. He used to have nightmares, and I... Well, I'd hug him in his sleep, and usually that calmed him down. Then, when he wakes up, he pretends it never happened at all. I know some of it, not all. When we were in Moscow last year, a Russian comes up and says that he had a gun to Jack's head once. Altman's head turned at that one. But he said it like a joke or something. Then he said the gun wasn't loaded. Then we had dinner together, like we were pals or something. And I met his wife. Pediatrician, would you believe it? She's a doc, and her husband is the head Russian spy, and...
It does sound a little far-fetched, Dr. Alexander agreed with a judiciously raised eyebrow. And then a real laugh happened on the other side of the table.
It's all so crazy, she concluded.
You want crazy? We have 2 Ebola cases reported in Sudan. Now that her mood had changed, he could talk about his problems.
Funny place for that virus to turn up. Did they come in from Zaire?
Gus Lawrence is checking that out. I'm waiting for him to get back to me, Professor Alexander reported. It can't be a local outbreak.
Why's that? Altman asked. Worst possible environment, Kathy explained, finally picking at her lunch. Hot, dry, lots of sun. The UV from the sunlight kills it.
Like a flamethrower, Alex agreed. And no jungle for a host animal to live in.
Only 2 cases? Kathy asked with a mouthful of salad.
At least Alexander thought he'd gotten her to eat. Yep, he still had a good bedside manner, even in a cafeteria. He nodded. Adult male and a little girl, that's all I know right now. Gus is supposed to run the tests today, probably already has.
Damn, that's a nasty little bug. And you still don't know the host.
20 years of looking, Alex confirmed. Never found 1 sick animal. Well, the host wouldn't be sick, but you know what I mean.
Like a criminal case, eh? Altman asked, poking around for physical evidence.
Pretty much, Alex agreed. Just we're trying to search a whole country, and we've never figured exactly what we're looking for.
Don Russell watched as the cots went out. After lunch,
Today it was ham and cheese sandwiches on wheat bread, glass of milk, and an apple. The kids all went down for their afternoon nap. An altogether good idea, all the adults thought. Mrs. Daggett was a superb organizer, and the kids all knew the routine. The beds came out of the storage room, and the kids knew their spaces. Sandbox was getting along well with young Megan O'Day. Both usually dressed in Oshkosh Bagosh outfits decorated with flowers or bunnies. At least a third of the kids had them. It was a popular label. The only hard part was parading the children into the bathrooms so that no accidents happened during the naps. Some happened anyway, but that was kids for you. It took 15 minutes, less than before, because two of his agents helped. Then the kids were all down in their cots, with their blankets and bears, and the lights went down. Mrs. Daggett and her helpers found chairs to sit in and books to read. "Sandbox is sleeping," Russell said, stepping outside for some fresh air. "Sounds like a winner," the mobile team thought, sitting in the den of the house across the street. Their Chevy Suburban was parked in the family garage. There were three agents there, two of whom were always on watch, seated close to the window which faced giant steps. Probably playing cards, ever a good way to pass dead time. Every 15 minutes, not quite regularly in case someone was watching, Russell or another of the crew would walk around the grounds. TV cameras kept track of traffic on Ritchie Highway. One of the inside people was always positioned to cover the doors in and out of the center. At the moment it was Marcella Hilton. Young and pretty, she always had her purse with her. A special purse of a type made for female cops. It had a side pocket she could just reach into for her Sig Sauer 9mm automatic, and two spare magazines. She was letting her hair grow to something approaching hippie length. He'd had to tell her what a hippie was, to accentuate her disguise. He still didn't like it. The place was too easy to approach, too close to the highway with its heavy volume of traffic, and there was a parking lot within plain sight, a perfect spot for notional bad guys to do surveillance. At least reporters had been shooed away. On that one, Surgeon had been ruthlessly direct. After an initial spate of stories about Katie Ryan and her friends, the foot had come down hard. Now visiting journalists who called were told, firmly but politely, to stay away. Those who came anyway had to talk to Russell, whose grandfatherly demeanor was saved for the children at Giant Steps. With adults he was simply intimidating, usually donning his Secret Service sunglasses, the better to appear like Schwarzenegger, who was shorter than he by a good 3 inches. But his sub-detail had been cut down to 6. 3 directly on site and 3 across the street. The latter trio had shoulder weapons, Uzi submachine guns, and a scoped M16. In another location, 6 would have been plenty, but not this one, he judged. Unfortunately, any more than that would have made this daycare center appear to be an armed camp, and President Ryan was having trouble enough. "What's the word, Gus?" Alexander asked, back in his office before starting afternoon rounds. One of his AIDS patients had taken a bad turn, and Alex was trying to figure what to do about it. "ID is confirmed. Ebola Mayinga, same as the 2 Zairean cases. The male patient isn't going to make it, but the child is reportedly recovering nicely." "Oh? Good. What's the difference in the cases?" "Not sure, Alex," Lawrence replied. "I don't have much patient information, just first names. Saleh for the male and Sohaila for the child. Ages and such." "Arabic names, right? But Sudan was an Islamic country." "I think so. It would help to know what's different about the cases." "I made that point. The attending physician is an Ian McGregor. Sounds pretty good. University of Edinburgh, I think he said. Anyway, he doesn't know any differences between them. Neither has any idea how they were exposed.
They appeared at the hospital at roughly the same time in roughly the same shape. Initial presentation was as flu and or jet lag, he said.
Travel from where, then? Alexander interrupted.
I asked. He said he couldn't say.
How come?
I asked that, too. He said he couldn't say that either, but that it had no apparent connection with the cases.
Lawrence's tone indicated what he thought of that. Both men knew it had to be local politics, a real problem in Africa, especially with AIDS.
Nothing more in Zaire?
Nothing, Gus confirmed. That one's over. It's a head-scratcher, Alex. Same disease turned up in two different places, 2,000 miles apart, two cases each, two dead, one dying, one apparently recovering. McGregor has initiated proper containment procedures at his hospital, and it sounds as though he knows his business.
You could almost hear the shrug over the phone.
What the Secret Service guy had said over lunch was right on target, Alexander thought. It was more detective work than medicine, and this one didn't make a hell of a lot of sense. Like some sort of serial murder case with no clues. Entertaining in book form, maybe, but not in reality.
Okay, what do we know?
We know that Mayinga strain is alive and kicking. Visual inspection is identical. We're running some analysis on the proteins and sequences, but my gut says it's a one-to-one match.
God damn, what's the host, Gus? If we could only find that.
Thank you for that observation, Doctor. Gus was annoyed, enraged, in the same way and for the same reason. But it was an old story for both of them. Well, the older man thought, it had taken a few thousand years to figure malaria out. They'd been playing with Ebola for only 25 or so. The bug had been around, probably, for at least that long, appearing and disappearing, just like a fictional serial killer. But Ebola didn't have a brain, didn't have a strategy, didn't even move of its own accord. It was super adapted to something very limited and exceedingly narrow, but they didn't know what. It's enough to drive a man to drink, isn't it?
I imagine a stiff shot of bourbon will kill it too, Gus. I have patients to see.
How do you like regular clinical rounds, Alex?
Lawrence missed them, too.
Good to be a real doc again. I just wish my patients had a little more hope.
But that's the job, ain't it?
I'll fax you data on the structural analysis on the samples if you want.
The good news is that it seems pretty well contained, Lawrence repeated.
I'd appreciate it. See you, Gus.
Alexander hung up.
Pretty well contained?
That's what we thought before.
But then his thoughts shifted, as they had to. White male patient, 34, gay, resistant TB that came out of left field. How do we stabilize him?
He lifted the chart and walked out of his office.
So I'm the wrong guy to help with the court selections? Pat Martin asked.
Don't feel too bad, Arnie answered. We're all the wrong guy for everything.
Except you, the president noted with a smile.
We all make errors of judgment, Van Damme admitted. I could have left with Bob Fowler, but Roger said he needed me to keep this shop running, and...
Yeah, Ryan nodded.
That's how I got here, too.
So, Mr. Martin?
No laws were broken by any of this.
He'd spent the last 3 hours going over the CIA files and Jack's dictated summary of the Colombian operations. Now one of his secretaries, Ellen Sumter, knew about some rather restricted things. But she was a presidential secretary, and besides, Jack had gotten a smoke out of it.
At least not by you.
Ritter and Moore could be brought up on failure to fully report their covert activities to the Congress, but their defense would be that the sitting president told them to do it that way, and the special and hazardous operations guidelines appended to the oversight statute give them an arguable defense.
I suppose I could get them indicted, but I wouldn't want to prosecute the case myself, he went on. They were trying to work on the drug problem, and most jurors wouldn't want to hurt them for doing so, especially since the Medellin cartel came apart partly as a result.
The real problem on that one is the international relations angle. Colombia's going to be pissed, sir, and with very good reason. There are issues of international law and treaties which applied to the activity, but I'm not good enough in that field to render an opinion. From the domestic point of view, it's the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. The President is Commander-in-Chief. The President decides what is or is not in the country's security interest as part of his executive powers. The President can, therefore, take whatever action he deems appropriate to protect those interests. That's what executive power means. The break on that, aside from statutory violations that mainly apply inside the country, is found in the checks and balances exercised by the Congress. They can deny funds to prevent something, but that's about all. Even the War Powers Resolution is written in such a way as to let you act first before they try and stop you. You see, the Constitution is flexible on the really important issues. It's designed for reasonable people to work things out in a reasonable way. The elected representatives are supposed to know what the people want, and act accordingly, again, within reasonable limits. The people who wrote the Constitution, Ryan wondered to himself. Were they politicians or something else? And the rest? The chief of staff asked. The CIA operations? Not even close to any sort of violation, but again the problem is one of politics. Speaking for myself, I used to run espionage investigations, remember? Mr. President, what beautiful jobs they were. But the media is going to have a ball, he warned. Arnie thought that was a pretty good start. His third president didn't have to worry about going to jail. The political stuff came after that, which was, for him, a first of sorts. "Closed hearings or open?" Van Dam asked. "That's political. The main issue there is the international side. Best to kick that one around with state. By the way, you've got me right against the edge here, ethically speaking. Had I discovered a possible violation against you in any of these three cases, I'd be unable to discuss them with you. As it is, my cover is to say that you, Mr. President, asked me for an opinion on the possible criminal violations of others, to which inquiry I must, as a federal official, respond as part of my official duties. You know, it would be nice if everybody around me didn't talk like a lawyer all the time, Ryan observed crossly. I have real problems to deal with. A new country in the Middle East that doesn't like us, the Chinese making trouble at sea for reasons I don't understand, and I still don't have a Congress. This is a real problem, Arnie told him. Again. I can read. Ryan gestured to the pile of clippings on his desk. He'd just discovered that the media graced him with early drafts of adverse editorials scheduled to run the next day. How nice of them. I used to think CIA was Alice in Wonderland. That's not even AAA ball. Okay, the Supreme Court. I've read over about half of the list. They're all good people. I'll have my selections this time next week. ABA is going to raise hell, Arnie said. Let 'em. I can't show weakness. I've learned that much last night. What's Keelty going to do? The President asked next. The only thing he can do, weaken you politically, threaten you with scandal, and force you to resign. Arnie held his hand up again. I'm not saying it makes sense. Damned little in this town does, Arnie. That's why I'm trying. One crucial element in the consolidation of the new country was, of course, its military. The former Republican Guards divisions would keep their identity. There had to be a few adjustments in the officer corps. The executions of previous weeks hadn't totally expunged undesirable elements, but in the interest of amity, the new eliminations were made into simple retirements. The departure briefings were forcefully direct. Step out of line and disappear. It was not a warning to be disregarded. The departing officers invariably nodded their submission, grateful to be allowed to live. These units had mainly survived the Persian Gulf War. At least a majority of their personnel had, and the shock of their treatment at American hands
had been assuaged by their later campaigns to crush rebellious civilian elements, replacing part of their swagger and much of their bravado. Their equipment had been replaced from stocks and other means, and that would soon be augmented as well. The convoy